Good morning, Dr. Ross. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
And I'm pleased to say, because I can hear you have a wonderful voice, as always, you must be over that dreaded lurgy you had last week.
Just barely, mate. It's been a real struggle, this thing, but anyhow, I am slowly getting better.
That's good news. Okay, let's get stuck into it with some questions. Billy says, I've noticed my sleep quality has declined recently, and I'm often tired during the day. What could be causing this, and how can I improve my sleep without relying on medication?
Well, firstly, Billy hasn't told us whether Billy is a male or a female and how old Billy is. But let me make a point that every adult male and every postmenopausal female, to some extent, suffers a degree of sleep apnea. And one of the major symptoms of sleep apnea is feeling tired during the day. So the big question I ask all my patients here is, when you wake up in the morning after what you perceive to be a decent night's sleep, are you waking refreshed or unrefreshed? If you're waking unrefreshed, you almost certainly have either sleep apnea as the most common diagnosis or some other sleep disorder. There's quite a few less common sleep disorders that can do this. So first protocol for Billy is to go to the GP, discuss it with the GP, and possibly get a referral to a sleep centre for either a home sleep monitor or to be admitted overnight to have their sleep assessed and consider whether they have sleep apnea and need treatment for it, because it is the commonest cause of exactly what Billy's describing.
Okay, there you go, Billy. Elaine is 68. Elaine says, I'm on long-term medication for high blood pressure. But Elaine worries about the side effects. Ross, she says, are there any long-term side effects or risks associated with taking blood pressure medication for a long time?
Look, anyone listening to this, just let me make the point. There are long-term risks of doing anything. So if I line up 100 people and give them any pill at all, 90 think I'm a genius and 10 want to throw it at me. Because there's about a 10% side effect rate for all medications, some medications even higher. So with blood pressure pills, firstly, yes, there are some potential minor complications if you're on them for a long time, but it's much worse to have poorly controlled blood pressure, which is definitely associated with a much higher risk of stroke, which can totally ruin your life, heart attack, sudden death, kidney failure, damage to your eyes. Blood pressure is bad for everybody who has it, and it must be managed. Now, that doesn't mean you always need to be on pills. There are 5 lifestyle things you can do to minimize your risk for blood pressure or to minimize your blood pressure. Number one, and this is the most important thing, and I'll make a strong point about this, is lose abdominal fat. So if all my patients lost somewhere between 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 kilos, depending on how much they needed to lose, I'd be twiddling my thumbs all day. I'd have absolutely nothing to do. Number two is 3 to 5 hours every week of moderate exertion. Number three, avoid sugar and salt like the plague because it drives your blood pressure through the roof. Number four, manage your stress as much as anyone can. And number five, keep your grog down. So they're the 5 natural things you can do. There's also some natural products you can take. The bergamot products that I have an association with, one of those twice a day, that's BJE 100 is the right one to take. That's not a product, that's the ingredients. I'm not saying the product on air. Kyolic garlic is also the ingredient, 2 of those in the morning. And most people love to hear this, a couple of pieces of dark chocolate every day, greater than 70% cocoa. But also, we've just mentioned sleep apnea, which also drives up your blood pressure. Once you've done all of those things as best you can, then it's medications. And look, most people over the age of 60 have a degree of high blood pressure, and most people need to be on blood pressure pills. The pills may cause some long-term effects, but it's nowhere near the deleterious effect of having poorly controlled blood pressure.
Can I ask you a question for myself? I'm 65.
Yep.
And I have relatively normal blood pressure, around about 120 over sometimes 72, 75. It might be a 124 over 75 or 79, but that's relatively normal blood pressure for a man my age. Is that correct?
No, that's abnormal blood pressure for a man your age. because it's low. It's great. I would kill to have a blood pressure like that.
I wanted to ask you this question. Does this mean because at 65 I have that blood pressure reading that I will most likely not have a problem in my life with blood pressure, high blood pressure? I might die from something else, but maybe not blood pressure.
It's unlikely. And having had the pleasure of meeting you, you are thin. So people that don't have abdominal fat tend not to have the blood pressure that people have a bit of abdominal fat. So your blood pressure is excellent. I would congratulate you, but you are the exception, not the norm for people over the age of 60 as far as blood pressure goes. But it's highly likely that as you get older, it'll stay where it is if you keep your body looking as good as it is.
Thank you so much, sir. Arthur says, I've been experiencing occasional chest tightness, but it doesn't always feel serious. How can I tell if it's something minor or a warning sign of a bigger heart issue?
Well, look, Arthur, can I make the point to you, my friend? Symptoms are always your ticket into the system. And I don't care whether the chest tightness is minimal or whether it's severe, you must always have it checked. So the first thing you do is you don't exercise until you've had it checked. So that's one of the worst things people can do, say, I've got some chest tightness, I'll go for a run to see if it gets worse. Good way to kill yourself. You go to your GP, you get a referral as quickly as possible to a cardiologist who can do a stress echocardiogram on you, and you shouldn't be waiting 3 or 4 months for the test. So your GP needs to ring the cardiologist and say, I have a patient who has chest tightness. Can you see them as soon as possible? This happens to me all the time. GPs ring me and you have to squeeze people in.
Peter's 56 and he says, I've started noticing stiffness and pain in my joints, especially in the mornings. Could this be the early signs of arthritis?
It certainly is. Yeah, stiffness, pain, especially in the morning, is typical of an autoimmune disease such as rheumatoid arthritis or one of the other arthropathies that can affect the joints. There's a whole lot of autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid, like lupus, mixed connective tissue diseases. All of these things can present with what we call arthritis or arthralgia. So arthritis is really where you get pain, swelling, stiffness and tenderness over the joint, whereas arthralgias are just pain and a bit of stiffness. So it's a bit like osteoporosis is loss of bone mass, whereas osteopenia is just the before you get osteoporosis. It's the same thing, arthralgia before you get arthritis. So something like that, Peter really should be getting off to the doctor and having some basic tests, some inflammatory markers, some tests for rheumatoid. There's a whole lot of specific tests that are done. And if there is anything that suggests a significant inflammatory condition, he needs a referral to a rheumatologist to get good long-term management. Because the earlier you get onto disease-suppressing therapy, the less chance you have of that arthritis becoming a deforming arthritis where your life becomes really significantly disabled.
Brian is 52. He says, I've had a mole that's recently changed shape and colour. How urgent is it to get something like this checked out, and what should I expect during an evaluation?
Look, it may be nothing, but when a mole changes colour or size or whatever, or starts to get itchy or bleeds, that's when you know there's the potential it may have turned into a melanoma. And I would not be leaving this too long. I'd be getting a referral off to a skin specialist or a person who specializes in skin cancers and getting the thing removed and biopsied and looked at under pathology to see what it is. Now, it may just be a mole, but it also could be something more serious. Don't wait until a few months. Don't wait. I mean, look, we're getting just before Christmas. Maybe if you couldn't get a referral or couldn't get in until, say, early January, that's not going to be a big deal. But I wouldn't be leaving it for 6 months and watching it.
Mike doesn't give me his age, but he says, lately, I've been feeling overwhelmed and unmotivated, but I'm not sure if it's just stress or something more like depression. How do I know when it's time to seek professional help?
Oh, look, I think if you're feeling overwhelmed and unmotivated and there's a very obvious reason for it, then I think you've got to do something about the obvious reason for it. So, for example, a person who goes into a doctor and says, I can't stand my partner, my kids are on drugs and I hate my job and I feel depressed, that is not depression, that's grief. That's a different thing. Whereas if you just out of the blue start to feel, oh, look, I can't cope with this, I couldn't be bothered doing things, you start to feel tired, and especially if you wake up at 2 in the morning staring at the ceiling for an hour or so, we call that early morning wakening, they're all the cardinal symptoms of endogenous or chemical depression. And you see, this is where antidepressants get a bad press. The person who hates their partner, kids are on drugs, hates their job, they've got grief. Antidepressants don't do a damn thing for that. But when you have endogenous depression, that's where in many cases, 70-80% of cases, the antidepressants will give you significant relief and are very good therapies. There are newer therapies coming through as well. Even the old magic mushrooms, the psilocybin's been shown to be quite effective. There's a thing called transcranial brain stimulation. There's some work on medical cannabis. So there's a lot of new treatments coming through for endogenous depression and also talk therapy to actually go to a good psychiatrist who can give you the medications but also talk through some of your issues. That helps as well. But I wouldn't be leaving it too long, Mike. I'd be getting assessed pretty quickly.
Okay, Ross, let's do some topics for this week.
Yep.
Number one, consuming a large share of your daily calories after 5 o'clock, as in 5 p.m., can lead to elevated glucose levels, increasing the risk of type 2 diabetes,
yep,
heart disease, and chronic inflammation. Now, according to new research, these findings add weight to the idea that lighter, earlier dinners are better for your health.
Look, when we talk about the best diet in the world, i.e. the Mediterranean diet, it's not actually the Mediterranean diet, it's the Mediterranean lifestyle. So what do I mean by that? Well, people who live in the Mediterranean villages, I'm not talking about people who live in Rome or Florence or people who live in Athens, I'm talking about people who live in those villages. They wake up in the morning, they have a good-sized breakfast that's full of fresh fruits and grains. Then they go off and burn off any extra carbs in the hot Mediterranean sun in the morning, come home and have their biggest meal at lunchtime, where they have a family meal, have a glass or two of red wine, some pasta, make them sleepy, so they have a nice sleep after lunch, and then they get up in the afternoon and go and burn off any extra carbs in the hot Mediterranean sun in the afternoon, and they don't have much for dinner. What do? So maybe avoid breakfast or lunch, or maybe have a little bit for those two things, snack throughout the day, and have our biggest meal well after 5 o'clock, and then sit down in front of that ridiculous thing called television and don't burn off the fat. So the body's not like a car. You put fuel in the car, use it when you like. Whereas with the body, you put the fuel in the body. If you don't burn it off, it gets laid down as fat. And this study is showing not only does it get laid down as fat, but in the 26 people who they evaluated between the ages of 50 to 70 who were already carrying excessive weight, pre-diabetic or diabetic, showed a marked deterioration in their ability to handle sugar if they ate after 5 o'clock. So it's because with our circadian rhythms, we release hormones at different times and the body copes better with eating earlier because also you're moving more during the day than typically you are at night time.
The takeaway from that is if we're going to have a main meal, if we're over the age of 50, should we try and have that main meal at lunchtime rather than at dinner time?
Yeah, it's better for you. So I think, yes, if you're happy to do that. But a lot of people do enjoy their evening meal, going out for dinner, etc. And one thing you can't measure in your bloodstream. So that's why I don't think we should do everything based on what it's doing to our health. So the thing you can't measure in your bloodstream is a thing called pleasure. So I think it is important to have a bit of pleasure as well. So let's get a balance here.
Now, brief bouts of fear, like those experienced in haunted houses, may actually help reduce low-grade inflammation. This is according to new research, Ross.
Yeah, I put this in my thing, I have in my show called The Weird File. 113 adult visitors, average age about 30, majority female. So adult visitors to, wait for this, a high-intensity haunted house attraction, they had their parameters of inflammation and stress measured before and after they had the fright of the haunted house. And in fact, it actually improved the immune system. So basically having a bit of a fright or doing some high-risk activities is actually probably good for your health. And you see, this is the interesting thing, Brent, is we were designed to wander around the jungle for 30 years. The only stress we had was the acute stress of the kill or the stress of avoiding being something else's lunch. Whereas now we live in a society where we're exposed to chronic stresses all the time and we know beyond a doubt those chronic stresses have this chronic release of cortisone and adrenaline, not good for you. whereas the acute stress appears to do something.
So what's the takeaway again from that?
You've got to have a bit of excitement in your life, whether it's a bit of stress or you go to a hoarder's house, have a bit of fun, have a good laugh, or whatever. It actually improves your immune system when you challenge the body acutely. But the takeaway for me is don't chronically challenge the body with chronic stresses. And you think about the modern world, where even there's complex travel, complex jobs, complex relationships, people just aren't relaxing or resting.
All right. Frequently, yo-yo dieting may significantly increase the risk of heart disease by disrupting the immune system and promoting inflammation. This is according to a new editorial. The findings highlight the importance of maintaining a consistent, healthy diet for cardiovascular health.
Yeah, well, you just summarised it beautifully. I see so many patients who say to me, which I find quite bizarre, oh, doctor, 3 years ago I lost 15 kilos. I felt so well. Have a guess what, Brent? It's all come back on. And they do it again and again and again. And the interesting thing is you'd think, oh, it's better to do that than just be fat all the time. But what this is saying is that it's even worse to do that because you keep overloading your arteries and getting more inflammation in the body by the yo-yoing. And I think one of the reasons for this is that when somebody has significant abdominal fat, if you go on a yo-yo diet, you tend to lose that fat rapidly, pours into the central circulation, and that abdominal fat isn't just an ugly lump of lard. It's also a toxic reservoir that's held on to all the synthetic chemicals you've been exposed to over the past 10, 20, 30, 40 years. So if you break that down rapidly, you're getting all these dangerous chemicals released into your circulation. So when you lose weight, you should do it very, very slowly over a period of months and months and months, and not be too disappointed if after a few months you've only lost a couple of kilos. Do it slowly. So slow and steady wins the race, especially with weight loss.
Women who drink regular non-fermented milk may face a higher risk of heart disease and heart attacks. This is new research. And fermented milk products, however, appear to have absolutely no such negative effects at all.
Yes, but here's the key to me. It's not that the full fat versions of milk or the skim milk that's good for you and the full fat's bad for you. It's the protein in the milk. So this study out of Sweden looked at 100,000 Swedish men and women over a couple of decades in two very large multi-decade cohort studies and found that women who consume more than, on average, 300 mils of regular milk or more per day compared with those who had less than 100 mils had a 21% increased rate for cardiovascular disease. But here's the key, my friend. Professor Julie Campbell from the University of Queensland, I think it was about 15 years ago, fed a bunch of rabbits either beta-casein A1 protein or beta-casein A2 protein. And she found that the rabbits who were given the A1 protein promoted the buildup of fat in the wall of their arteries, the atherosclerosis you and I have spoken about on numerous occasions, whereas A2 protein prevented the same buildup. And there's some really interesting stuff around this. So you're probably not aware, but there's a north-south gradient from the top of New Zealand to the bottom of the South Island of New Zealand. And going with that is that as you go down to the bottom of the South Island, the amounts of A1 milk in the cows, because they changed the breeding, the different types of breeding cows, there's more A1 cows in the South Island. In the North Island, the cows make more A2. The Maasai in Africa drink from zebu cows, which exclusively produce A2, and they have almost no atherosclerosis. And if you compare the risk factors for heart disease between Belfast and Toulouse, they're identical. Same cholesterol, same blood pressure, same cigarette smoking, but there's three times more heart disease in Belfast than there is in Toulouse. And interestingly, in Belfast, they have these Ayrshire cows, which have three times higher levels of A1 milk compared with the Jersey cows in Toulouse that have three times higher rates of A2 milk. But you could argue, of course, living in Belfast, much higher stress levels. Their alcohol of choice is Guinness rather than red wine. So you can't always say it's due to one thing. Now, let's go back to the Swedish study. The dairy cows in Sweden are what we call Holstein cows, which produce very high proportions of A1 milk. And when you look at the studies, there's a thing called the PURE study, 220,000 people, 50 different countries over 9 years, showed that those people who had an average of 100 grams of red meat per day, 3 servings of high-fat dairy per day, had a 25% reduction in all-cause death and cardiovascular disease. And also another study of 30,000 Europeans over 15 years showed a 23% reduction in type 2 diabetes. So I suspect the reason why the women were copying it in Sweden was because they were drinking milk that was high in A1 protein, nothing to do with the fat content. And why it didn't affect the men, possibly because men tend to have bigger arteries than women, although men tend to get heart disease 10 years before women. So very, very interesting stuff. But I think this is why we should go more towards A2 milk. And in Australia, anyhow, our standard milk is 60% A2, 40% A1.
Blokes over the age of 60, should they be drinking regular milk for their bones?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. And no, you have it in your coffee. I mean, I don't drink dairy only because my wife says I snore more with dairy. So I have oat milk, which is not really milk. But I have oat milk, and I still get the calcium in the oat milk. I just don't get the dairy. But I have no concerns about this high-fat versus low-fat nonsense. It's nonsense.
So you have raised a good question for me. I used to drink a lot of milk in reference to coffees, 3 or 4 coffees a day, and I would have milk all the time. I have changed that, and I'm now drinking, like you, oat milk. I don't drink a lot of normal dairy milk, as in cow milk.
Yeah.
So I'm still getting calcium when I'm consuming oat milk, am I, Ross?
Yeah, of course you are. Yeah.
Okay, I better let you go. Just one quick question before I do. Last topic, researchers have uncovered a surprising link between COVID-19 and cancer research, revealing that the virus can trigger immune cells with anti-cancer properties. They say the discovery could lead to new treatments for aggressive, treatment-resistant cancers, Ross.
Yeah, now we're not suggesting that during the COVID pandemic, people with cancers were getting COVID and their cancers were regressing. I'm just saying in a clinical analysis of taking the RNA, which is the copy of DNA from the SARS-CoV virus, it triggered these particular type of immune cells that attack cancer cells. And so what they're suggesting is maybe if they could harness these cells in cancer patients, they may be able to improve the therapies that are being offered.
Yet again, you amaze us. You really do. Thanks for doing the listener questions. You do it so well. We appreciate it so much. Only a couple of weeks left before we all have a Christmas break. So we'll let you go. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we'll look forward to talking to you next Saturday.
Lovely to talk to you, mate. Thank you.